You're listening to Well Made, a podcast from Lumi about the people and ideas behind your favorite online brands. I'm your host, Stefan Ango. Dave Heath, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. Excited to be here.
So you're the co-founder of Bombas. Bombas is a direct-to-consumer sock company. How would you describe it these days?
Yeah, so we're predominantly direct-to-consumer. So we just launched a little bit of wholesale this last year, but I can get into that later. But yeah, predominantly direct-to-consumer apparel company that focuses on delivering the most comfortable products in the world to our customers while also giving back to our community. The company was founded when we found out that that socks were the number one most requested clothing item at homeless shelters. And so feeling inspired by other give back companies, we wanted to help solve that problem. And so we decided, you know, we would adopt the one-for-one model and donate a pair of socks for every pair of socks that we sold.
So you launched in 2013, and there's some big milestones along the way that we'll talk about, but you were on Indiegogo, you were on Shark Tank. Since then, you've grown to actually ship or send out over 10 million socks that were part of your one-for-one program. Can you give us a sense of the scale of Bombas today?
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, we're just over 5 years old from when we initially launched on Indiegogo in August of 2013. We have just about 70 employees here in New York. We grew the company to about $50 million of revenue last year. We're looking to more than double that again this year. And, you know, more importantly than anything else, I think following just this kind of recent push in the holiday season, we've now donated over 15 million pairs of socks to those in need.
Wow, that's incredible. What were you doing before you launched Bombas?
How far back do you want me to go?
Well, I'm just curious, like at the moment you had this realization that socks were the most requested item at shelters, what were you doing at the time?
Yeah, so I mean, I was working at a media company that was definitely a startup. You know, here in New York, it's actually where I met one of my co-founders, Randy. Been there for about 6 years. I joined as the seventh employee. We grew the company to about 140 people. So I really had a firsthand experience in watching a company grow very quickly. And I think a lot of the experiences that Randy and I had working there together really helped shape how we ran our business, both the positives and the negatives. But I mean, from a very young age, I always knew that I wanted to be an entrepreneur. My dad was an entrepreneur. I watched him build a company from the basement of our house to eventually selling that company to a publicly traded company. From as young as I could remember, you know, watching him kind of build that. And this was long before kind of venture firms and all the startup, you know, stuff that the age that we live in today. So he really built his business brick by brick. And I just remember always wanting to, you know, be like my father. So followed that path from a very young age of starting lemonade stands to washing cars to walking dogs to a mobile DJ business I had in high school to selling Cutco knives in college while all of my friends had real internships. You know, I was always kind of doing my own thing.
What was your dad's company? What did he do?
So it's a company called Fibar. Whenever you see wood chips on playgrounds, he invented the safety system that utilizes wood chips on playgrounds. So it's one of those oddities, but everybody knows about it. It's kind of everywhere. But yeah, that was my dad's business. He started it with $5,000.
That's amazing. Yeah. He must have been pretty supportive of your efforts, I'm guessing, as a youngster.
Incredibly, yeah. Grades were not my strong suit. I definitely had more street smarts than book smarts. I was always way more scrappy, and you know, I kind of knew that grades were not going to be the thing that got me through life.
Can you remember any lessons, like early lessons from your dad trying to teach you the ropes of like starting a business?
Just that you have to kind of be willing to do everything at any given moment. So I remember, you know, he would take opportunities and, you know, when he had to basically really early days, he had to package up a bunch of samples for trade shows and stuff. And looking back on it, I'm like, oh, is this child labor? But he had me and my brother, you know, gluing plastic tubes together that could like, you know, then put all the you know, the layering of the safety system in. you know, and he would kind of turn this into somewhat of a game, but realizing now he really just was, you know, getting us to work for free. But, you know, he was doing it right alongside us and packaging boxes. And I just remember that one of the lessons is that you kind of have to be willing to do everything. And I remember very early on in Bombas, you know, one of those kind of parallel moments for me was I handled all of our customer service for the first 9 months of the business. So all emails, all calls would go to my cell phone. I'd be out at dinner on a Saturday night and I'd get a random phone call from some area code I didn't know. And I'd pick it up and I'd have to be like, hey, this is Dave from Bombas. How can I help? And I would take like customer service calls from wherever I was, you know, no matter the situation.
Can you recall any important phone calls, any ones where there was a customer was really upset about something or like something that was really remarkable about one of those calls or emails?
So two of the calls, this is actually, and this goes to show that like, you never know, you know, what happens. And I always say you take every call, not just for customer service standpoint, but early on in your entrepreneurial career, you take every call and you take every meeting because you have no idea where it's going to lead. We got two investors actually through customer service. So, you know, one guy had handled really well and he was like, oh, if you're ever looking for capital, let me know. And I was like, you know, I don't know if we're going to ever do that. But, you know, sure enough, when the business grew and, you know, we were looking for capital, I emailed this guy not thinking it would turn into much. Today, he turns out to be our largest single investor. So he put in $200,000 in our seed round and $400,000 in our Series A. And I never met the guy. It just literally through customer service.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
What about product inquiries or anything that you learned from talking to people that actually turned into improvements to the product or improvements to the platform?
Oh, well, that happens every day. I mean, customer service is still something that, you know, we run in-house here at Bombas. It's one of the lifebloods. I mean, when you're running a direct-to-consumer brand, it's really your only direct touch point with the customer. You know, you can either try to treat it as like, okay, we just have to like manage it and, you know, be as efficient as possible and keep costs down. Or you can turn it into the way that, you know, we approach it, which is, you know, how can we use this as a way to endure better customer loyalty, find out things from our customers about ways that we can either improve the site experience or improve, you know, new product development. And so much of kind of all of the improvements around the organization from a customer facing standpoint, actually, a lot of them originate from customer service. So when we're talking about new product lines and, you know, new site features, these are all things that you can't have better data than the thousands of people that are going through your site every single day or interacting with your brand on a regular basis.
As you've scaled the company to 70 people, though, you're not doing all the customer service yourself. How have you managed to keep, you know, tabs on what people are asking for? Like, what is the mechanism within the company that allows that feedback to filter back to the product development?
So, you know, one of the ways in which we've kind of established our company culture is that there's a high degree of transparency across every single department. And no matter if you're the most junior person in the company or the most senior person in the company, you're always encouraged to raise your hand and share information that you think could be useful to helping the organization run better. So if you're in customer service and you see an opportunity for operations in the warehouse to make improvements that can, you know, result in, you know, a better customer experience or, you know, shorter ship time that might result in better lifetime customer value, you're encouraged to do that. And so everyone within our customer service organization obviously funnels up through our VP of customer happiness, you know, and he sits in on the executive meetings and shares kind of, you know, the hard data around, you know, this is how many, you know, inquiries we're getting for XYZ new product or, you know, XYZ new size or, you know, new feature on the site. And so he's really filtering all of it up. But I constantly have, you know, people, I run office hours, you know, 2 hours a week, where I invite anybody in the organization to come in and ask me questions, share ideas with me. And most recently, someone from the customer service team came in and shared three things that they thought that we could improve on the site. I left that meeting, I told our chief technology officer, and within 2 days, all of those changes had been fixed that then had a much better, you know, resulted in a much better customer experience on the back end.
What's your area of responsibility these days? What are you working on?
You know, I feel like it's a funny and interesting question. It's ever changing, but one of my kind of big goals right now is actually to remove myself from everything and to not really play a major role in any one part of the organization. You know, I think from the organization which Randy and I came from, we experienced a CEO that he was a genius and, you know, he's very, very good at, you know, kind of everything, but at scale, he wanted to be involved in everything or needed to be involved in everything. And so I think when we started Bombas, it was kind of my one promise to myself and the organization was that I was never going to be a bottleneck for anybody. And so it's less me and it's more so making sure that people feel empowered, you know, and confident to make the decisions within their own departments. It's almost like the parent, you know, in the swimming pool, where if you're constantly holding your child who's swimming, they're never going to learn how to swim, right? It's the kids who learn how to swim or the parents who are willing to push their kid away, take a few steps back and let their kid come and try to swim to them. I think there's a lot of parallels in that kind of analogy to what it takes to be a good leader, especially at scale. We're doubling the team every single year. We're doubling revenue every single year. The volume that that's going to have to start to take on. And we've got 30 open hires right now. I can't possibly be involved in every single decision-making aspect within the organization. And I know that if we're going to be a 300 to 500 person organization in the next 3 to 5 years, I've got to start implementing a lot of these, you know, those processes and thinking today so that bad habits aren't formed for the future. Because it's a lot easier to move 70 people than it is to move 500 people.
When you see someone who you're managing or helping and they're about to make a big mistake, what is your process for guiding them? When do you decide it's okay, let's just let them make that mistake and that'll be an important learning experience versus where do you guide them towards what you think might be the right solution to that problem?
You know, I've got to be honest, I'm not involved enough to catch the mistakes before they happen. The way that I really kind of operate and, you know, as the CEO is that me and the executive team, you know, we decide on the strategy and, you know, the vision for the organization and where we're going to go. We set up a plan. We put that plan in place. And then honestly, once that plan starts going into place, I start spending my time thinking about the next thing. You know, I tell everybody that as the CEO, I'd say 75% of my time is spent thinking about what's happening 12 to 18 months from now and what are the plans and processes and hires and systems and, you know, technology that we need to put in place today? What's the seed that we need to start planting today so that it grows into a full grown, you know, fruit bearing tree 12 to 18 months from now? 25% of my time is spent on kind of more reactionary stuff where people will come and will say, okay, we tried to implement this plan. Here's what worked. Here's what didn't work. How should we react? And I sit in some of those meetings to help kind of brainstorm around, you know, what are the solutions that we can implement that we can be agile to for some of the stuff that didn't work. But I'm a participant. I'm not the director in that scenario. Because frankly, I don't know as much as anybody who's doing the job day to day. What I try to bring is my blinders aren't on. I'm not staring at this thing. You know, it's like you ever try to solve a problem that you know, you're racking your brain against and you know, you're staring at it for an hour, you walk away and then 15 minutes later you come back and you're like, oh, I got the answer, right? Like, it's because sometimes you need the perspective of taking a step back. And that's, again, what I really see my role as CEO is doing, is providing the outsider's point of view, because sometimes I think people get too close to it.
It sounds like you have a tremendous amount of trust in your team. Is there anything?
You have to.
Yeah. Is there anything that you've done in terms of your hiring practices to find really great people that you could trust?
So I get this question a lot. Unfortunately, there's like, it's hard to quantify. There's no like silver bullet. There's no like, oh, do this one tip and you will hire the best people. You know, I do think a lot of it is gut. I think you have to kind of, you know, when you meet somebody, you have to just figure out, you know, whether or not you think like this person gets it. and core values, actually. I mean, if there is one kind of tip around hiring, it's establishing what your company's core values are. And then whenever you're interviewing somebody, benchmarking them against your core values and asking them or asking them questions that'll help you understand whether or not you believe that they will adopt or embrace or make decisions based on the core values that you set in the organization. And then the other one, which I'd say is like, it seems somewhat obvious, but we always hired the best talent possible and didn't try to take salary or budget into it whenever we met someone that was really freaking great. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of times in the organization, our CFO would say, well, this person wants 100 grand. We've only budgeted 80. Like, they're 20% out of our budget. And I'd be like, yeah, but this person punches at 40% above their weight. Like, there's no way we can't not have this person. And there's not been a single instance where I've looked back and said, oh, that was a really bad decision for hiring the better person, even though it was slightly out of their, slightly out of budget. Top performers will always outperform, is kind of my opinion. And you're doing yourself a disservice by not taking the absolute best candidate possible.
Can you speak to some of the values of Bombas and how you test for those?
Yeah. So one of them is deliver a high quality customer experience. And so I can give a number of examples where you're faced with questions that'll say, oh, if we moved from XYZ shipping provider to this other shipping provider, we'll save, you know, 25% of the cost, but it will add between 1 to 2 days on the shipping time, for instance. Well, our core value is not how do we save as much on shipping as possible. Our core value is deliver the best customer experience possible. And so whenever we're faced with a question about that might compromise one of our core values, the immediate answer is, I don't care if it generates $4 million of savings in a year, that goes against one of our core values. You know, another one is, you know, our employees love working here. I remember from the first year, we always knew that we wanted to do company retreats because we always thought it was an amazing opportunity to get people out of the office, put them in an environment that's not about work and allow cross-departmental conversations and relationships to form that really start to knit the bond of a family beyond, you know, just being simply coworkers. You take, you know, 20 people to go skiing in Utah and, you know, people are forced to sit on a chairlift and you ask yourself, you're like, can we really afford $25,000 to take, you know, 20 people skiing for 4 days? And every time I've looked back, I say like, we couldn't not afford $25,000 to do this. Every single time. And our retreat budget has grown to like $300,000 to take 70 people, you know, on an airplane to some location within the United States. And watching the, you know, the bonds that are formed as a result of kind of these one-off experiences, when you're sitting in a kayak with somebody, you're not getting to the same level of depth just by grabbing a coffee or a lunch with somebody in the office. When you're kayaking around a lake for 45 minutes, you find out really deeply personal stuff about these people so that when push comes to shove and you know, tensions and stresses get high as they inevitably do in a, you know, again, in a fast growing business, especially around this time of year in Q4, it's like our Super Bowl. When, you know, the customer service department comes over and they're getting crushed because of something that's happening at the warehouse, it's not personal. You know, people don't, you know, start to attack each other because they know that this is the person that whose mom suffered from the same, you know, disease that my mom suffered. You know, so it becomes, it's like really hard to explain, but when these kind of deeply personal bonds are formed, the amount of output that comes out of that is exponential.
One of the values I'm sure is important to the company as a whole is around the mission that you've developed to do this one-for-one program. Yep. I want to get into a little bit more of the nitty-gritty of how that works, but you mentioned at the very beginning, it came from this insight of hearing from shelters that socks were the most requested item. Talk about that moment. Can you like actually go back in time to who it was that told you that, or why were you in that place at that point in time? Like, how did that actually come about?
So it was actually just a post on Facebook. I happened to have been scrolling.
Wow. This is the first time I've ever heard. That was like a life changing thing that happened from a post on Facebook.
Right.
Amazing.
The power, I guess, of social media. Ironically, I don't really use any social media anymore. But it is interesting that I kind of owe a lot of where I am at today to a post that I saw on Facebook. But yeah, I was just scrolling and there was a guy holding a sign, that said, most people don't realize socks are the number one most requested clothing item at homeless shelters. And I didn't immediately go, oh my God, there's a business here. I sat there and I was like, oh, that's kind of sad. Like something that I've never spent more than a few seconds of my day thinking about is, seen as a luxury to somebody else. And I just found myself over the next couple days and weeks just telling anybody that that would listen. I was like, hey, did you know that socks were the most requested clothing item at homeless shelters? And I got similar responses of like, no, I didn't. That's like interesting, but also pretty sad. During that time, this was February of 2011. So Tom's was in their fifth year of business. We all kind of know of them as this kind of behemoth they are today, but they were only 5 years old at the time. And growing very rapidly. Blake was obviously on kind of the, all over the place, giving this kind of talk for one for one and, really pioneering this movement. Warby Parker had just launched about 6 months prior and also was getting a ton of press coverage. And when they originally launched, one for one was a really large part of their brand campaign. That's when the aha moment came to me. And I was like, wow, if, like this can be done with shoes and eyewear. Why can't it be done with socks? That was really the catalyst for everything. I mean, a lot of people think like I sat down and had this idea for a sock company. It's like most people don't sit down and dream of starting sock businesses.
Yeah.
it's not the most obvious endeavor to go after.
But I do think that people can relate emotionally, even if it's, on a much smaller scale. Everyone's had that feeling of, walking around outside for a day and then you come home. Maybe you're camping or something and you put on a fresh pair of socks and that's an amazing feeling. Imagine if that was your life every single day.
And what most people also don't realize, is because these people are often living outside on the streets, they are afraid to take their shoes off because they're afraid someone will steal them. And when walking around is your main mode of transportation, all of a sudden you think about how reliant you are on kind of foot health and foot care. I always tell people, like, we've all probably been in a situation where we've had to wear a pair of pants without underwear and you make it through the day just fine. But if you've ever had to wear a pair of the shoes without socks, you can go about a few hours before blisters start and before your feet start sweating. And imagine if that was your life every single day. It really starts to put it all in perspective as to why indeed this is the number one most requested. And also, homeless shelters for a lot of reasons won't accept used socks. People don't donate used socks because they're a wear-through item. And so it requires shelters to actually go out and buy new socks themselves or have people go out and buy new socks to donate. So it is a very real problem that we're solving. And honestly, I was never so high and mighty about this where I was sitting there and going, we're really changing the world in some major way. I was just like, we want to provide a little bit of comfort to somebody who doesn't have it. But then here we are 5 years later and we hear stories like from one of our shelter partners down in North Carolina. They said because of the last 3 years, because they haven't had to buy socks, they were able to send two kids from their community to college as a result of the money that they saved from buying socks. And then I'm like, whoa, okay, that's like real impact.
One thing that I heard you mention somewhere else was that the product itself is different for the shelters. You're making a special kind of sock for them.
That's right.
Was that true from the beginning, or how did you develop the sock that was going to be for the donation program?
So when we first started, actually, we donated the same pairs of socks that we sold to our customers because I wanted anybody who was living on the streets to be able to, experience that same level of joy and comfort that I did, that our customers did whenever they put on a brand new pair of Bombas. And one of the things that we implemented very early on in our company culture was, allowing people to take socks out into the streets as they were walking to and from work or going to grab lunch and having those one-on-one interactions. And so every new employee who starts at Bombas is handed 12 pairs of socks that they're required to give out within their first week of starting employment.
Wow.
And one of the things that we learned really early on is that all of our socks when we first launched were, you know, pretty brightly colored. They were black and gray, but they had blue, neon, orange, neon, yellow, and pink accent colors. The two pieces of feedback that we'd get is that people preferred the black versions versus the gray, and oftentimes asked if we had versions without any bits of color on it. That got us thinking, and we started calling our charity partners, and we're like, hey, why are we getting all these, you know, requests for just kind of plain black socks? And they're like, well, they sew dirt less. And so there's kind of a human dignity element to not wanting to stand out, you know, with brightly colored items and wanting things that just don't show as much visible wear. That's when like the second light bulb went off, and we're like, maybe the product that we're selling to our customers is not the same product from a use standpoint that are, you know, the people who are living in the homeless community are facing. And so we went back to the drawing board and gathered all this bits of information. And, you know, ultimately our donation sock is a sock that features an antimicrobial treatment that prevents the growth of fungus because they don't get to wash their socks as often as our customers do. We reinforced all the seams to provide greater durability because, again, oftentimes they're wearing one pair of socks for, you know, 7 to 14 days at a time. And then the third was obviously making it, you know, all black to help minimize the show of dirt and visible wear.
How did you go about finding all of the local community partners that you're working with?
The funny thing is it started before we even launched the company. It started with a Google search. I just went in and I said, you know, homeless sock charity or something like that. And only really one organization came up. It was an organization in Toledo, Ohio named Hannah Socks. And I randomly reached out to them and I was like, hey, I'm starting this company, you know, we're going to be donating socks for a pair of socks we sell. Like, could you be a partner of ours where, you know, you'll accept the socks? And of course they were like, yeah, this is like our whole, you know, this is what we spend all of our time on is gathering socks to distribute out to our partners throughout the country. And obviously, as we started to grow and get more brand awareness and, you know, PR and, you know, be featured more places, there was no shortage of inbound, you know, requests being like, hey, how do I get some of these donation socks? And so then we had to start building a team around just managing our giving partners because they're our customers as well. But again, very different needs, right? We're shipping thousands upon thousands of pairs to, you know, these individual giving partners, whom now we have over 2,000 giving partners throughout the entire country, represented in all, in every single state. And so our kind of long-term vision and goal is to be able to, you know, from a technology standpoint with our customers, really close the loop so that when you place an order on Bombas, one of the emails that you get back in kind of the post-email drip campaign matches kind of your zip code with the zip code of the shelter that's closest to you and says, like, here's some information about how we're kind of giving back to, you know, to your local community, and, you know, really close that loop and invite them to go volunteer there if they want to. But yeah, we now have an entire team just dedicated to managing all 2,000 of our giving partners. And I think distributing 10 million pairs of socks in a single year is a very large undertaking.
Yeah, just a logistical challenge in its own right.
Yeah. And so one of the things that we're really excited about is we're launching something called our Shelter Finder, which allows customers to go on and put in their zip code and find the shelters that are our shelter partners that are closest to them so that they can, you know, connect with them. Because a lot of times our customers are like, I want to get involved. I want to give back to my community the way that you guys are. How can I do that? A lot of people just don't know where to even begin. So we're hoping that as we continue to invest in technology resources around our giving program, that we'll start to really close the gap between our customers and, you know, those that we're serving so that we can kind of build around this ecosystem, which again starts to play into our branding around bees and being a hive and, you know, all
oh,
working
right.
together.
We haven't talked about that. I want to talk about that too. But wait, I do have a maybe like a trickier question for you, which is that it seems like in the past, you know, 5 years since you launched, in some places in the US, things have gotten a lot worse. Like in San Francisco, I'm here in LA where things are maybe not quite at that level, but we do see, you know, a tremendous amount of inequality, and the situation seems to be getting worse. Like, what's your point of view on that? How do you feel companies should be maybe doing more to help?
You know, I try not to take a super righteous stand. It's one of those things that I think you have to come to on your own. You know, obviously, I'm a huge proponent of, companies figuring out ways to give back to their local communities. And I actually think that capitalism, by the pure nature of the theory, is that, you know, if you do it correctly, you should yield, profits and growth. I believe that it is the responsibility of every member in the community, whether you have a business or you don't have a business, to help those that are less fortunate in whatever way that is. And, you know, if that means donating your time, donate your time. You know, it's one of these things where a lot of small acts can really make up to a very large impact. But, you know, like there's forces at work here that are beyond even my understanding from, you know, a macroeconomic political perspective. And I'm not going to sit here and tell you that I have the answers on how to, you know, solve homelessness in the United States. But what I do know is that every single one of us, myself included, could all find more time or find more ways to give back. And that collective effort, if everybody did that, would have a very, very large impact on our country as a whole.
One choice that you made as a company is to get the B Corporation certification. And I'm just curious if you can give people a little bit of background on what that is and why you made that choice.
Ever since we learned about it, right, it was something that I think we knew we wanted to do. I do remember being like, oh, wow, it's really difficult for a 6-person organization to get B Corp status, because you have to fill out this, you know, pretty lengthy questionnaire. I think it's like 400 questions, and, you know, to like answer correctly for 95% of all of the 400 questions. And some of them are like, what's your maternity policy? Like, what's your, you know, how are you committed to packaging sustainability or, you know, clean water, you know, workplace things? And you're like, we're 6 people, like no one on our team is pregnant, so we don't have a maternity policy yet. You know, there were just a lot of things that required a lot of thinking and processes, I think, to put in place that no small organization, you know, in the early days will ever do. And frankly, actually, it was one of our customer service people that came. I remember him pulling me aside and was like, hey, you know, like, I've been doing a lot of research on B Corp. Why aren't we a B Corp? And I was like, honestly, I would love to be one. Nobody right now, I think, has any, you know, of the resources or time to really kind of take on this as a project. And he was like, well, what if I did it in my free time? And sure enough, him and one of the people in our finance department, they pulled it off. And I'm so glad that they did, because A, we're among a bunch of great companies, and B, I think that as a fast-growing company, establishing ourselves as a B Corp is a signal, I think, to all other companies out there that you can be big, you can grow fast, while also be committed to running your organization in an ethical and benevolent type of way. And I think one of the interesting things about it, specifically thinking back on it, was that one of the main benefits as to why we wanted to do it was that once we're certified B Corp, if we ever go to sell the business, one of the standards of B Corps is that whoever the acquirer is has to agree to adopt your B Corp policies. So we couldn't sell the organization and have somebody swipe away our, you know, one-for-one giving program, you know, the way that we treat paternity and maternity leaves, you know, all of the kind of aspects of the business that we kind of hold in value as to what we believe makes this place so special. They couldn't take those things away just for the sake of profit. That was one of the major drivers for me in trying to make sure that we did eventually get that status.
Yeah, I guess I'm curious if that's something that you're doing for yourselves, for your customers. Is it something you found difficult when it came to raising money, for example? Did people challenge you on that question to the point of, you know, the governance piece of it and how, you know, that might affect an acquisition or something like that?
No, you know, it's really, It's really been a positive across the board. I think with all of our giving and kind of everything related towards trying to be a company that stands for things that are greater than just revenue and profits, I think we try to, maybe even to a fault, I think we're a little bit humble about it and try not to be, you know, too boastful. It's this really fine line of trying to like educate your customers on the good that you're doing while also making sure you don't come off sounding like you're just patting yourself on the back or singing your own praises. So I don't know how much of a role it's played, you know, externally, but you know, when it came to fundraising conversation, it never came up as really an issue. I think anybody who would look at the success and the growth of our business, you know, from where we are 5 years ago to where we are today, I think it would be next to impossible to separate out a portion of that success being attributed to the fact that, you know, so much of our brand ethos is rooted in kind of giving back and just being a company that stands for good.
I'm going to make a terrible segue here, but speaking of B Corps, your logo is a B, B-E-E. Mm-hmm. Yeah, sorry, but I just couldn't help myself.
And
you were mentioning the concept of the hive and the name Bombas, meaning bee in Latin, like where did that come from?
Well, it was derived from the Latin word for bumblebee.
Okay.
So it's bombus, which are B-O-M-B-U-S.
Got it.
You know, due to like Google search terms and stuff, we wanted a unique name. So we changed the U to an A. But yeah, you know, when we were sitting down early on, we obviously wanted a name and a logo and something that kind of encapsulated what we were standing for, you know, from having our company DNA being rooted in kind of giving back to the community. And one of my very brilliant co-founders, who's a former creative agency guy, tucked away for a few weeks and then emerged and he was like, I've got a bunch of options. And we ended up settling on bees because bees and ants outside of human beings are truly the only two, mm-hmm. you know, creatures on the planet that are 100% altruistic and will give their life for the greater good of their community. And so, you know, it was obviously, you know, something that we related to and, you know, working together, and the fact that socks are a small clothing item, but they can have a meaningful impact on someone's life. Bees are small creatures, but yet they have an immense amount of impact on our planet. Just kind of everything that encapsulated around the way that bees work together was something that we fell in love with and you know, quickly adopted to be what our brand stands for.
Have you read the book Out of Control by Kevin Kelly?
I have not.
Oh my gosh, you got to read it.
I'm writing it down right now.
It's an amazing book, I think from 1992 or something like that.
Okay.
Kevin Kelly was actually a very early guest on this podcast and is sort of a futurist. The cover of the book has bees on it. It's really a book about the concept of emergence, mm-hmm. which is seems almost like a theme of the way even your management philosophy is, which is this idea that complexity can come, like sophistication can come from a very simple set of rules. And bees and ants are mentioned in that book as,
100%.
You know, a really good example of that, where very simple rules about, you know, how an ant follows another one down a path. And it's actually kind of a very democratic concept where a bee is, you know, finds a source of pollen. And the more bees go in that direction, the more they attract more bees to go over there. And it's a very interesting idea of how more complex structures like democracy and big organizations can develop out of really simple rules. So it's a really, really good book. And it was very influential to like the movie The Matrix and all kinds of other stuff.
Cool.
So I would very highly recommend it. Yeah. Or listen, if someone's listening out there and wants another podcast to listen to, Kevin Kelly, I think it was episode 5 or 6. But I think you would enjoy that a lot.
Cool. I'm excited about it.
I want to talk really quick about Shark Tank before we wrap up. I'm just curious, how did that influence the course of the business? Do you think of it as an important milestone? Was it essential to growing the company? Would you have done it differently at all?
You know, it's always so hard when you look back on kind of, you know, the journey and to say like, what were the pivotal moments in the company's success? I mean, certainly at the time, there was no bigger moment. I mean, we've been in business for 13 months by when our episode aired. It aired on the season premiere of season 6, so in September of 2014. So again, we were 13 months old. Up until that point, we've done about $900,000 in revenue. And then we're on this show, and within, you know, a month, we've done over $1 million in revenue. So it definitely was a springboard or a catalyst or, you know, whatever you want to, you know, however you want to define it. It was definitely a moment in the company that I think shaved off time from our kind of growth trajectory. But I would like to think and believe that, you know, we play a larger role in kind of the overall growth and success of our business, that we would have made it here regardless. But I mean, you know, we got like 50,000 customers in a 1 month period, when prior to that we had like 5,000. You know, it's like, it is a massive game changer for sure. And I would definitely do it all over again. And in fact, actually, a lot of the companies that I either invest in or advise for in kind of the consumer space today, I'm always encouraging them to like go on Shark Tank. And because, you know, I've got relationships now with the producers and the casting people, you know, I can help them kind of shave off the weird experience of having to go audition in person. But
yeah, because you didn't have to apply; they came to you, right?
Yeah, I mean, so you know, they have a casting department, you know, that are out there looking for interesting businesses, and not surprisingly, I think they look to things like Kickstarter and Indiegogo, because
right
on the surface of the website, on the page, they can see how successful something is or isn't. And then they can click play on a video and watch what the founders are like, you know, on camera, and see whether or not the audience reacted well to that. It's a very good kind of filter for them to use as a way to kind of see what cream rises to the top. And so, you know, we had a very successful Indiegogo campaign, and I think they must have seen it and saw us on the video. And, you know, I don't know, they must have thought that it would have translated well onto television. And we jumped through a lot of hoops for them. But eventually, yeah, we made it on air. And something that, you know, if you have the opportunity, I encourage all entrepreneurs to do it if you're confident in your business, because it is pretty game changing from an awareness perspective.
Was it challenging logistically? When all of those orders came in,
God,
did you have the inventory? How did you figure out that part?
Horrific. you know, if there's one lesson that I, you know, if you are a direct-to-consumer company and you're going on Shark Tank, move your website over to Shopify immediately. You know, we were on Magento. It crashed about 30 seconds after,
oh my gosh,
you know, after our faces appeared on television. You know, crashed a bunch of times for the next 48 hours. We had people, you couldn't even imagine the amount of like hate mail that we were getting. Like, oh, you're an idiot. How did you not know that this was going to happen and plan for it? I was like, first of all, they call you 2 weeks before your episode's going to air to let you know. So there's really not a whole lot that you can do in that 2 week period to plan for the volume of users that you're going to expect. Again, unless you're on Shopify, which can scale instantly.
Right. Cause, and I think this is something people don't know. I don't think people know this, but they will shoot a whole bunch of episodes and not tell you whether your episode will be aired at all.
You can film and make it all the way to May.
Yeah.
And never air.
Yeah, and they just don't tell you until it's like the week before, the 2 weeks
right
before. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah. So yeah, we ended up selling out of all of our inventory within a month of airing. So, you know, look, all good problems to have, but small team, we had like 40,000 customer service tickets within the first like 7 days of being on Shark Tank.
Wow.
It was like completely overwhelming. And so, you know, there are certainly challenges that come with scale. Everybody thinks that, oh, you just grow really fast and it all just must be like roses the entire time. You know, we're dealing with quite similar issues right now. I mean, we beat projections by 35% for Black Friday, Cyber Monday. And, you know, we hired customer service people and, you know, our warehouse staff according to a plan that was 35% lower than what it is. And so now, you know, we're 5 days behind on responding to customers about like where their order is. It sucks. I mean, it like crushes me, crushes my soul because, like, again, when one of your core values is deliver a high quality customer experience and you're not able to deliver on that, it's like, you know, like part of you feels like you're dying inside. But, you know, we'll get through it. And, you know, again, good problems to have. But unfortunately, the customer doesn't, you know, is not benefiting from these good problems.
This was your fifth Black Friday, Cyber Monday weekend, right?
Yeah.
Was there anything else that you picked up over the years that you did manage to avoid?
Honestly, you know, it's so hard because it's such a large number, you know, what we end up doing. You under or over project anything by 10%. And just because the number itself, you know, order volume wise is so large, you know, it make a massive swing in any direction on really kind of the operationally intensive parts of the business, the warehouse, customer service, inventory. You know, how do you plan for something that, you know, to give you a perspective, we did more on Black Friday in 24 hours than we did in the first 2.5 years of our business. Like, how do you plan for something like that? It's just like, yeah, it's insane. But the one thing that we have taken away is to no longer be entirely surprised by what it could be. You know, it's a resource game, right? And so I think next year we now are, you know, we're bigger, we're more profitable this year. We'll have the ability to over-invest resource-wise. And even if Black Friday doesn't kind of yield the same kind of, you know, 1.5 times, 2 times growth that we experienced, you know, all the first 5 years, we'll at least be better prepared for it. And we could afford to take a little bit of a hit because, you know, of the place that the company is in.
Is there anything that you would do differently if you were going back in time and telling your past self, like, hey, watch out for this, Black Friday or otherwise, about the company?
I think the one thing that I would say is that, you know, I think the way that we've grown our organization and the way that we've kind of planned things out is that we've erred on the side of being conservative rather than being overly aggressive. That for us was fundamental, I think, in just the strategy that we had set from the onset, which was, you know, we didn't want to be one of those, you know, brands or e-commerce companies that went out and raised $50, $100, $200 million and found ourselves 5 years later with a $400 million company that was losing $50 million a year. Like, I could never wrap my head around how that is, like, that as a business model. Like, I would find that so incredibly stressful to be burning that kind of cash. So we said from a very early, you know, point on that we weren't going to raise a lot of capital and that we were going to try to be as profitable as quickly as possible. You know, when you're planning that way, you plan for basically cash flow. And so when you're planning for cash flow, you plan for the worst case scenario so that you don't run out of cash. The problem is that when you plan for the worst case and you don't plan for the best case and the best case happens, you find yourself on the other side of that coin where you're completely overwhelmed, you're understaffed, you're under, you know, allocated from an inventory perspective. You have customers complaining about things being out of stock and, you know, where's my order and why aren't I not getting a response as fast as, you know, a company who might have a customer service team of 100 people. You know, there are trade-offs that you have to make. But again, it was a business decision that we decided early on. I mean, we only raised $4 million of capital, which in my mind, I'm like $4 million, that's a lot of money. But by comparison, I think to some of our peers who've gone on to raise, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, you know, we decided to do it in a lot more scrappy manner. But you pay for that. I mean, your team works longer nights and longer hours as a result of it because you can't throw every resource that you want at the problem. You have to be more scrappy. And that's where we balance things by, you know, giving people, the entire company closes for the last 2 weeks of the year, because between November and December, that's our Super Bowl. And we do 50 to 60% of our revenue within an, you know, 8 week period of time. We have to make sure we balance the other side of that by giving people time off and giving them the ability to recharge.
This has been so insightful. I really appreciate it. I have about 12 other topics that I didn't get to, so I'm going to have you back for a part two at some point. But
I'd love that.
If people are interested in your socks, in your products, in giving back, bombas.com, that's BOMBAS. Is there anything else you want to point people to?
No, I mean, you can find all of the resources if you want to get involved from a giving aspect. We've got a giving page. Obviously, if you want to buy our product, we wouldn't be doing our jobs if we didn't make that real easy by just going to bombas.com. All new customers get 20% off their first order. We're big believers that once you try our product, you'll never go back. Or feel free to reach out to our team. We're also hiring. That's like a big, big, big thing. So if you're in the New York City area or you want to move to the New York City area, we're like hiring like crazy. We're looking for incredible, amazing talent. This will be somewhat of a shameless plug, but you know, the 5.5 years that we've been in business, only 3 people have ever voluntarily left the company. And one was to get their MBA at Harvard. One was to start a venture firm with their former professor. And one just recently moved home because she was super homesick. And we also just got named #2 best places to work by Cranes in New York City. So if you are looking for a job or you want to change your career, this is a really awesome place to work. And we welcome amazing talent. So please go search out our jobs that are available.
What's the URL for that? How do people get there?
In the footer. I mean, if you Google jobs at Bombas, you'll find our greenhouse link. Or if you just go to our website, you'll see a jobs tab in the footer of the website.
That's amazing. Thank you so much, Dave.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, if you got something useful out of it, I would love to hear what that was. Consider writing a short review. Could be just a sentence long, by going to iTunes and searching for Well Made. I want to hear it all. I want to hear good, bad. I want to hear your constructive criticisms. I am just trying to make this show as useful as possible for you. So tell us what you think. That is the very best way that you can support the show. Thanks, and see you next time.